On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a week of turmoil. A Koran burning at the U.S. base draws Afghan protesters to the streets. Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum face off in Arizona over health care reform. Romney blames his rival for supporting Senator Arlen Specter.
He voted for Obamacare. If you had not supported him, if we had said no to Arlen Specter, we would not have Obamacare. So don't look at me. Take a look in the mirror.
And on Wednesday, Britain's Sunday Times reporter Marie Colvin gave one last report from Syria just hours before she was killed.
These are 28,000 civilians, men, women, and children, hiding, being shelled, defenseless.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, David Shepperson of The Detroit News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You could join the conversation. So what's your prediction for Tuesday's primary? Can Santorum top or stop Romney? What's your top story this week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Washington, D.C., we're joined by David Shepperson. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Also from Washington, we're joined by another David, Ignatius. He's columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. His latest novel is Blood Money, a novel of espionage. David, nice to talk to you, too.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Mike, David, and David.
David Shepherdson, I'll go to you first because the primary in Michigan looms. Two big Detroit newspapers endorsed Mitt Romney, yours and the Free Press, but they didn't endorse him very big. Historically, an endorsement from the newspaper is okay. It doesn't go very far. Is the sense in Michigan that this primary can't come soon enough, that Mitt Romney is just about frittering away every natural advantage he has?
This whole primary season has been basically about one issue, the auto bailout. And as you probably know, in 2008, Governor Romney wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt." And the whole issue has been whether could the auto industry have survived without a government bailout? Of course, first President Bush and then President Obama ended up setting aside $85 billion to save both General Motors and Chrysler. And Governor Romney has really been trying to make the point that the companies could have survived without a bailout, but almost all of the outside experts, the former auto advisor Steve Rattner, has said there was no private financing. The private sector had basically stopped lending, and that absent this bailout, these companies wouldn't have survived. And because of that, the auto bailout is still very popular in Michigan because of so many auto factories and workers there. But on the other hand, within the Republican primary base, about 73% of Republicans said to Gallup this week they oppose the auto bailout. So all the Republican candidates have opposed the bailout but yet are trying to thread the needle and say there was some other way you could have saved Detroit absent this bailout.
Jack Beatty, so the question is, you know, when Romney gets dinged, it's on a question often of flip-flopping or authenticity. He's sticking to his guns. He's saying what might be unpopular to the people of Michigan. Doesn't seem like he's getting a lot of credit for that stance, though.
No, and he may pay for it in the fall, where I see the president's numbers in Michigan look very good vis-a-vis Romney, the home state man. You quoted that bit from the debate where he turned the tables on Senator Santorum. I think that really highlighted one of the strengths he's shown throughout this debate process, and that is he is a master of oppo research. He did it to upend Newt Gingrich, you know, when he said to him, it turns out, Mr. Speaker, you're an investor in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and the speaker was speechless.
Yep.
And he did it with two words. He said, Arlen Specter, and that set off Senator Santorum on a 262-word apologia about, well, I didn't, it wasn't, and full of obscenities and so on, that did nothing but harm him. And it was really, again, the oppo research of of that Romney team.
And the failure of the other candidates to handle what should be known attacks, because you have to know what the other candidate is going to say. David Ignatius, what has struck you about these debates or the issues dominating these debates?
Well, the first thing is that they're riveting. I confess to having missed them. And Wednesday night, when it was time to watch the Republicans again, I looked forward to it. There has been drama in these debates. They've generally been pretty good debates. I thought the moment that Jack was just describing, when Romney asked, in effect, isn't Obamacare basically an extension of the ideas you pioneered and developed in Massachusetts? Gave the kind of almost ludicrous escape line, blaming Santorum for having voted for Arlen Specter, and managed totally to shift the debate and bury the fundamental question, which is a real one. Romney is good at that. I felt watching him that this is a kind of grinding political personality. He just goes after his opponents and shreds them. And at the end of each shredding, there's that little kind of knife-edge smile. It's not quite a smirk as he looks at them. And, you know, you can just see them all going, wow, you know, like that guy just took me apart. Is that an attractive style for the person we want to be president of the United States? I don't think so. And somehow he'll have to get past the persona that's emerged more and more strongly in these debates, the grinder, the guy who takes you down. I don't think that's going to win in a general election.
I would say Mitt Romney has not won every debate, but he hasn't lost any. And when other candidates pop up, like Whack-A-Mole, he whacks them down. David Shepherdson, here are the polls, not just from your state. In your state, it's very close. Romney has, maybe you have more recent poll numbers than I do, but it looks like Mitt Romney has a 2 or 3 percentage point lead. In Arizona, Mitt Romney has maybe an 8 percentage point lead, but all the polls that I've seen indicate that the more recent the polls were taking, the better Mitt Romney is doing, perhaps reflecting that the public thought he did well in all of these debates. Your thoughts?
No, I think that's exactly right. The polls have shown a boost for Governor Romney. Remember, too, he was in a lot of debates in 2008. I mean, he has spent almost 5 years essentially running for president. He's gotten a lot better in the debates this cycle versus last cycle. And, you know, even take the auto bailout issue. I mean, he, you know, talk about that Oppo research when, you know, Senator Santorum has made this argument that, hey, Governor Romney, you know, was willing to support the Wall Street bailout, but said, you know, turned his back on auto workers in Michigan. Romney said, well, hey, wait a minute, you supported bailouts for the airlines, for the steel industry, Senator Santorum. And, you know, he also was a bit on the defensive on that as well. So he's a very, you know, polished candidate. I mean, he's been saying almost word for word the same answer on the auto bailout and a bunch of other issues for over a year now. So, you know, he doesn't make a lot of mistakes in the debate, and he has been pretty skillful at turning, you know, some of his potentially biggest weaknesses, you know, back into onto the other candidates and to other issues.
Well, if you're like David Ignatius and you missed some of the debate, luckily enough, moderator John King provided a ultra Cliff Notes version, asking each candidate, well, here's how he asked the question.
Please define yourself using one word and one word only. Congressman Paul?
Consistent.
Senator Santorum?
Courage.
Governor?
Resolute.
Mr. Speaker?
Cheerful.
Although Gingrich got the big laugh with that, I would note that Rick Santorum did not answer in an adjective. It should have been courageous. So if you're a diction fanatic, you might want to ding him for that. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you watched the debates. What was your take?
Hi. Well, my take was that Governor Romney told a flat-out lie about his position regarding the morning-after pill in Catholic hospitals. I was here in Massachusetts when he was governor, so my ears really pricked up when I heard that. King said that Santorum and Gingrich have said during your tenure as governor, you required Catholic hospitals to provide emergency contraception to rape victims. Did you do that? And Romney said, quote, no, absolutely not, of course not. There was no requirement in Massachusetts for the Catholic Church to provide morning after pills to rape victims, end quote. But there's an article in the Boston Globe, December 8th, 2005, which says, Romney says no hospitals are exempt from pill law, and he reversed his own State Department of Public Health's opinion, saying that they would be exempt. And he was quoted as saying, the law is the law, and he said, quote, I think in my personal view it's the right thing for hospitals to provide information and access to emergency contraception to anyone who's a victim of rape, end quote. So Resolute is pretty laughable in view of the fact that he changed his own administration's position, required the Catholic Church to provide the morning after pill, and now is lying about it.
Thank you for the call. And the websites that issue Pinocchio's or Pants on Fire warning did say that Newt Gingrich was right, Mitt Romney was wrong. But the full context is that it's a little confusing, but Mitt Romney, or at least detailed, but Mitt Romney vetoed a bill that would make the morning after pill available over the counter at Massachusetts pharmacies and that would require hospitals to make it available to rape victims. He vetoed the bill. The legislature overturned the veto. And he said things like, in my heart of hearts, people who are subject to rape should have the option of emergency contraception. But then as governor, as the caller indicated, did overrule his own Department of Health. Quick question for you, Jack Beatty. Can you believe that contraception is still so center stage in these debates?
I just can't. It's like a replay of the 1950s. And yet, you would have thought this is really going to hurt Rick Santorum, who's been making statement after statement on this. Washington Post today, Santorum doing better, remarkably better in the last 2 weeks among Republican women. Go figure.
Yeah, we're talking about this. We're going to be talking about foreign affairs in the next segment. We invite you to join the conversation. Iran, is it just making noise? Are you really worried? Are you feeling pain at the pump? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Stay with me. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. What's your take on the situation in Iran? That Quran burning in Afghanistan, sky-high gas prices. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Sunday, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, told CNN's Fareed Zakaria that diplomatic negotiations are still the best means to avert Iran from developing nuclear weapons.
We are of the opinion that the Iranian regime is a rational actor. And it's for that reason, I think, that we think the current path we're on is the most prudent path at this point.
Iran, a rational actor. David Shepherdson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, is with us. Also, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor for the Washington Post, and Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. David Ignatius, you recently interviewed Leon Panetta, the defense secretary. Would he agree? Would he publicly agree that Iran is a rational actor?
Well, I recently described Leon Panetta's views. I wouldn't call it an interview. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting to me about General Dempsey's comments was that they were a public statement, almost point for point, of the views that I attributed to Secretary Panetta. That first, the U.S. doesn't think an Israeli strike would be efficacious. Doesn't think it would achieve its purpose. It would delay the program only briefly. That the U.S. has told Israel that it opposes this strike, that pressure from the U.S. has not yet been successful, that because Iran has not yet actually moved into a weaponization phase of its nuclear program, the U.S. thinks that it would be premature and not prudent for Israel to strike now. So it's fascinating to see the lengths to which senior officials of the U.S. government are going to communicate to Israel the U.S. government's view that it would be unwise to attack. We are just going to have to wait and see whether that U.S. pressure campaign has convinced Ehud Barak and Benjamin Netanyahu, the defense minister and prime minister respectively, to forego what U.S. officials believe is their strong lean towards striking these facilities before what they call the zone of immunity for Iran begins. Exactly what that is elusive. But General Dempsey's comments were fascinating. It's rare to see a top military officer as explicit as that about an issue that has so much political resonance.
Exactly. So you make the point that the audience for those remarks is Israel, and yet at the same time, the political conversation, especially among the GOP, is going like this. Here's Mitt Romney at the GOP debate.
This is a president who has made it clear through his administration and almost every communication we've had so far that he does not want Israel to take action, that he opposes military action. This is a president who should have instead communicated to Iran that we are prepared, that we are considering military options. They're not just on the table, they are in our hand.
Sounds hawkish. Jack Beatty, question to you. How long can the Obama administration communicate to Israel, urge caution when a lot of polls show that the American public is itself looking to take perhaps a hard line on Iran, if that's what's necessary?
Yes, a CNN poll, 75% of Americans believe Iran already has a nuke. And a recent Pew poll says 58% would want the United States to use force to prevent Iraq from developing nukes. So that's ominous. You have such a contrast between the things the candidates are saying and, frankly, between the president's, iteration, all options are on the table, and the hawkish noises coming from Israel. You have such a contrast between that and what experts are saying, what military and intelligence experts both here and in Israel are saying. We have Michael Hayden, former CIA director, who said that an attack would be beyond Israel's capacity, warned against the attack. You have Maya Dagan, former Mossad head, who warned last year that attacking Iran would mean regional war, and in that case, you would have given Iran the best possible reason to continue the nuclear program. So, here is a moment, really, where one man could play a really important role in history. That's John Kerry. William Fulbright, as David will remember, played a crucial role during the Vietnam War when, as early as 1965, he had a day of hearings, a little more than that, where George Kennan was the premier witness. And Kennan simply said, this war is not in the American national interest. He was not a hippie. He was the most distinguished diplomat we had. Kerry could hold hearings right now where essentially you could contrast the bluster of the candidates with what the experts are saying and educate the public to what's at stake, because these public opinion polls are ominous. This is the kind of thing that happened as we slid into the Iraq War, and we know, and the same people who urge that are urging this with undiminished vehemence. So this is a moment, I think, when someone could step up and make a difference.
David Ignatius, I want to go back to you. You talk to the experts all the time. This is your area of expertise. What do you think the best thinking is on Iran's capability, the capability of America or Israel to do something about it? I mean, we hear that the Israeli public, certainly Benjamin Netanyahu, is all but resolved that something is going to happen militarily.
Well, several things. First, on Iranian capability, the Iranians have been putting together the pieces that you would need to move quickly to build a nuclear weapon. But so far as U.S. intelligence knows, they have not actually entered that weapon building phase. Estimates of how long it would take them to move from where they are now to having a weapon range from 1 year on out to multiple years, and there's a degree of guesswork here. In terms of the urgency for the U.S. And Israel, it's really a question of the munitions they have, the firepower, the ability to stay persistently over the targets in Iran. Israel's air power generally is more limited than that of the U.S., so Israelis argue, we have to move sooner than you do. You can wait. If your red line would have you taking action sometime in 2013. Well, that's fine for you, but we can't wait that long. And what I think is Israeli officials have been saying to the U.S. is, if you think this is a bad idea, then stand aside and let us do it. But we need to make the decision about what we think is right for Israel's security. And that's part of why this is so difficult. How does the U.S. exert pressure on a decision that Israel insists in the end it's going to make for itself?
David Shepherdson, perhaps you want to take it from there, or perhaps you want to talk about what's going on in your home state and how this all redounds to another big issue, gas prices. But go wherever you want to.
Well, I was going to bridge those two issues because, you know, an Israeli or a U.S. attack on Iran certainly would have a significant impact on oil prices, which clearly could threaten both the U.S. and the world economic recovery. And already gas prices, which are up about 11% since mid-December to over $3.50 a gallon, it's the earliest the gas prices have ever been above $3.50 in the year, are already becoming a potent political issue. Gas prices are probably headed up above $4 again, at least according to most of the experts. And as a result, it also has impacts on the amount Americans are driving. Last year, Americans drove 35 billion fewer miles, the lowest number since 2003. Auto sales have rebounded, and there's also a concern that if gas prices keep going up, Americans will stop buying the largest, most profitable vehicles that the Detroit companies sell, SUVs and pickup trucks, and move in bigger numbers to smaller cars, more fuel-efficient cars. So, and I thought the other interesting thing at the debate was Governor Romney even was asked about the impact on oil if of an Israeli strike on Iran, said, frankly, that's not as important as ensuring that that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. So clearly the Republicans have staked out a ground to the right. They're certainly more hawkish on a possible attack on Iran, and it potentially could put the administration into a bit of a box.
A lot of things go into gas prices, certainly international affairs, certainly energy policy in the United States. Barack Obama yesterday at the University of Miami addressed the rising gas price issue, and here's what he said.
We need to keep developing the technology that allows us to use less oil in our cars and trucks, less energy for our buildings and our plants and our factories. That's the strategy we're pursuing, and that's the only real solution to this challenge.
We'll innovate our way out of it, he says. Kirk is calling us from Iowa City. Kirk, hello. You're on the air with us. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Mike. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My point is I don't really see any point in caring about how much per gallon the Middle East is charging us per barrel of oil, because the gas companies are still making billions of dollars in profits a year. So the Middle East is not the problem for how much our gas costs. If you're still making a $1 billion profit margin, then you're charging too much. And that has nothing to do with the Middle East at all.
All right. Thank you for the call, Kirk. Jack Beatty, I mean, in the last 4 minutes, we've heard, I think, 6 explanations for high gas prices. I think the case is they're all right. Are our politicians giving us a bill of goods when they say, oh, it's not drilling, or oh, it's not innovation, or oh, it's not foreign policy? It's everything, right?
It's everything. Yeah. And McClatchy this week did a service by having some reporting alleging and substantiating to a degree that there's a good deal of speculation that's driving this uptick in prices. And the president certainly was right yesterday when he says, look, there is no magic wand. That what we need to do, as he said, is to have an all-of-the-above strategy that insulates us as far as we can against these shocks from abroad. And, you know, the Republicans have charged that he has essentially abandoned American energy and that, he's almost not even an energy present, not present. Well, NPR reported this week that the number of drilling rigs in the U.S. Fields quadrupled under President Obama. Domestic oil production hit an 8-year high, and for the first time, I think, in decades, the U.S. is now a net fuel exporter. So the charge that somehow the president is not providing production of oil simply falls on its face.
And I should also add that top experts agree to answer what Kirk, our caller, was saying. It's all about profit. I think the best estimates I see is that the possibility of unrest in the Mideast does add a 20% to 30% premium to oil. So there's no getting around that what's going on in the Mideast is certainly affecting price at the pump, as they say, to some degree. Stuart is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
I cannot believe that we are on the verge of going into another Middle Eastern war. This is literally insanity after this disaster in Iraq. And the polls that you cite, while they are disturbing, I think they just show the general propaganda machine of AIPAC and Fox News, et cetera, because Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. So if the majority of Americans believe that, then they are, that's ridiculous. And just to point out the hypocrisy, you know, the U.S. has, 10,000 weapons, 5,000 to 10,000. Israel has a couple of hundred.
Nuclear, you mean,
we don't want Iran, and nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
We don't want Iran to have a handful. Last point is, Israel and U.S. actions are driving Iran towards a nuclear weapon, and if I was in their position, I would be doing exactly that.
Stuart, thank you for the call. I'm Mike Pesca. This is On Point. I don't know if the lesson of the nuclear state is get a nuclear weapon and we'll not mess with you. I mean, it seems like North Korea is pretty entrenched because one of the reasons is they have nukes, and the United States convinced Gaddafi to give up his nukes, and guess what? He tumbled. I don't know how much that plays into it. David Shepperson, here's what I wanted to ask you about the question of war in Iran. In Washington, you know, the war in Iraq was popular at first and very unpopular by the time it ended. In Washington, is there a sense that if it comes to pulling the trigger, so to speak, on war, that the public can be made to be behind it?
Yeah, I think there's a general consensus that there's always going to be a rally around the flag type of attitude if the U.S. opts to go to war. I mean, the support of the U.S. military is at all-time record highs. But if you look at the two wars that we have been in recently, you know, or three, you know, with Libya, you know, with Iraq and Afghanistan, these are wars that basically went on for 10 years, have cost trillions of dollars. And when you consider the all-in costs of, you know, long-term care for veterans, I mean, there's some argument that the wars could end up costing $4 trillion. So, you know, if you remember what former Secretary of State Colin Powell said about the Pottery Barn rule, you know, once you buy it, once you break it, you buy it.
Right.
And it's easy to go in to Iran, or somewhat easy. I mean, obviously, Iran has a pretty significant military, certainly more so than was in either Afghanistan or Iraq. But what are the what do we do after we either bomb facilities or if attempted something more serious? And what would the long-term strategy be for exiting? And obviously, you know, given all the uncertainties, in terms of regional stability and long-term costs, clearly, going back to what General Dempsey said, clearly there's a lot of risk and uncertainty to going down that path.
And we haven't even talked about the other flashpoint in the Middle East, Syria. The crisis escalates. Here, Sky News correspondent Emma Hurd.
This is the horror of Baba Amma. The shells blasting into a residential neighborhood. The regime's attacks relentless in an area of Homs where thousands of civilians are trapped.
David Ignatius, have you heard any good ideas from official Washington about anything the United States or the West can do or should do in Syria?
Well, I've heard a few. It's so painful for the world to watch the slaughter of these brave Syrians, the videos coming out of this neighborhood that the reporter was just speaking from, Bab Amma in the city of Homs, are especially grim. Today in Tunis, our Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her counterparts from many countries will meet as the Friends of Syria, in quotation marks, to talk about what additional steps could be taken. There's been a growing push to think about arming the Syrian Free Syrian Army But I think the U.S. and Turkey, the two key players, really continue to oppose that. I would expect today that there will be a decision for a humanitarian corridor of support and a 72-hour deadline for Bashar al-Assad to let that humanitarian aid in.
We are discussing the week in the news. What is your top news story this week? Up next, we'll talk about the Supreme Court revisiting affirmative action, the Virginia abortion decision. You could join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, it's Mardi Gras time. A New Orleans reveler dressed as a Mayan priest. He says it's important to enjoy the party before the predicted apocalypse in December 2012.
This is the last Mardi Gras since it's in the world, so you really have to have a really good time this year and just let loose.
British period drama Downton Abbey wrapped up its second season on American television. Stunning costumes, witty dialogue, and of course, romance.
I'm Tess of the D'Urbervilles to your angel Claire. I have fallen. I am impure.
Don't joke. Don't make it little, not what I'm trying to understand.
Thank you for that.
And at the White House, President Obama sang the blues with B.B. King.
Come on!
Obama may be the president, but we know who's king of the blues, and I'm sure one or two Republicans are going to put that in an ad. Yeah, baby, don't you want to go back to Chicago, they'll be saying. You can join the conversation. Were you rethinking your investments when the Dow hit 13,000? How about the governor of Virginia backing off the abortion bill? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. David Shepherdson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, is with us. Also, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor for the Washington Post, and Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. David Ignatius, I want to ask you about this incident with the burning of Qurans in Afghanistan. It led to protests. The protests led to death. Here's my question, and maybe is an unusual way to frame this. I want to be sensitive to all world religions. I think it's, of course, important if you want to talk about real politics, not to commit a blunder like this. People die. But the United States has 11 aircraft carriers, 61 destroyers, 5,600 manned aircraft, over a million just in the Army. We spend $648 billion to our Defense Department. How can it be that this entire apparatus, not to mention civilian contractors and the diplomatic corps, is at the mercy of a burned book? This buggers my mind. I understand it's the reality, but it just confuses and flummoxes me. How about you?
Well, I think part of the cultural sensitivity issue is that there is a background of anti-Americanism. There's a suspicion among Afghanistan's Muslims that Americans don't fully respect their religion. And so when you have incidents like this, they fall on dry tinder and suddenly you have a fire where you wouldn't expect one. Your point that we have so many people and somebody's going to do a dumb thing is right. I just ended up feeling this week that all of the programs, all of the – it's really millions of dollars we've spent on cultural sensitivity training, preparing these soldiers for combat in this particular area. It depends on the good judgment of what the military calls the strategic corporal, the low-level guy, you know, who's backing the truck up to the dump where the fire is, who looks in the sacks and says, wait a minute. These are Qurans. We can't burn these. And the strategic corporal either makes a decision that saves you enormous difficulty, or he doesn't. But that it's low-level decisions sometimes that can get you into very high-level trouble. And we're in that now. My takeaway from this, Mike, was that it made me glad that President Obama has got us on a trajectory to end our lead combat role in Afghanistan next year and hand it over to the Afghans. That seemed righter than ever this week.
Here's a web comment. AC3 writes, I don't want to be insensitive, but here's why I mistrust and dislike all religions. Why would the burning of a book spark this kind of ridiculous reaction? Aren't all Bibles more mass print aren't all Bibles just mass printed anyway? Aren't they the most selling books of all time? Can't you just print more? Well, that is certainly not how a Muslim would view it. But like we were saying before, and Jack Beattie, I'll throw it to you. What's your takeaway from all this? I mean, we are vulnerable to this, but we have to be smart about what the strategic corporal does, I guess.
Yes, but, you know, to have a policy that's hostage to a mistake at a level where mistakes are inevitable, I think it impeaches the policy. I mentioned a moment ago George Kennan's testimony before Senator Fulbright in 1965. He gave a sentence there about Vietnam that is just as applicable to Afghanistan. He said, "There is more respect to be won in the opinion of this world by a resolute and courageous liquidation of unsound positions than by the most stubborn pursuit of extravagant or unpromising objectives." One can hardly think of a more extravagant and unpromising objective than what we're about in Afghanistan.
I think that's a sound point, at least as far as what you were saying. When you have a policy that makes you vulnerable, your vulnerabilities are going to be exposed. Here, by the way, is the official explanation or apology. German Chief Coalition Military Spokesman, German Brigadier General Karsten Jakobsen, he said the partial burning of Korans at Bagram Air Force Base was an accident.
"This incident was completely unintentional. Material was inadvertently given to troops for burning. The decision to burn this material had nothing to do with it being religious in nature or related to Islam. It was a mistake. It was an error."
Let's pivot back to domestic affairs. The Supreme Court will take up affirmative action law. One argument goes, David Shepherdson, one argument goes that I thought this was settled 8 years ago. Is that a fair argument? Or if people feel very strongly about this and we have the courts as a means of redress, should the courts not wade into this argument just because, you know, we have only given administrators 8 years to figure out what we were doing last time?
Well, that's exactly right. In 2003, the court ruled in the University of Michigan case, Grutter versus Bollinger, but only by a 5-4 vote that the use of race in admissions was permissible. And, you know, I think the fact that the court is re-entering the debate in this University of Texas case so soon afterward, obviously the composition of the court has changed dramatically. You have to think that there's some likelihood that they're going to either pare back or reverse the decision. I mean, obviously goes to the fact that race remains such a difficult issue for the U.S. I mean, you know, look what's happened with Jeremy Lin and, you know, throughout the whole, you know, the whole society. I mean, race continues to be such a sensitive touchstone. And I think, you know, it's hard to see the court coming out of this without, you know, without wading into or offending certain sensibilities.
Jack Beattie, what about the argument that I guess there are two ideals here? One is if you're anti-affirmative action, let's say, or you don't like how the rules applied, you might say this is why we have the courts. We want justice, and this policy is unjust. On the other hand, you might be reasonable and say you can't keep redeciding this every 7 or 8 years. What do you think?
Well, that is the question. I mean, the first issue, cry for justice, is raised by Abigail Fisher, a young woman who said she was not admitted to the University of Texas, and African-American minority students were, who had inferior grades to hers, inferior SAT scores, and therefore she was the victim of an injustice. And, you know, I don't think there can be any question about how the court's going to rule. I mean, Justice Kagan has got to recuse herself because she was involved as Solicitor General with the administration's part of this, and so that's there are two new members since Justice O'Connor. Justice Alito, who replaced her, is against affirmative action. Justice Roberts has strongly said, he said, racial balancing is not transformed from patently unconstitutional to a compelling state interest by relabeling it racial diversity. So his views are clear, and it may well go down, which would now, you know, this is just at a time when we're learning about just how deep and intractable the problems of poverty, racial isolation, and schools that simply aren't performing, just how deeply they handicap poor children generally, African American and minority children particularly. And what a shame that if it does go down, that this one opening, this one sort of second chance that young people get who aren't so proficient with SATs, which are really just tests of cultural familiarity, but who can do the work. What a shame if this door should close to them.
I don't know. I think the SATs are okay for vocab and analogies. But then again, my bias is I was a teacher of the SATs for about a decade. Here we have a clip from Jonathan Turley, Current TV. Keith Oberman interviewed him. Turley was saying that conservatives on the court may want to hear a new challenge. We know that's true. Grutter versus Bollinger, Lee Bollinger, then president of the University of Michigan. Now he's at Columbia. That was the case they could be redeciding.
Clearly, four justices wanted to see this case on the merits. There's no question that they have the presumed five votes that could send Grutter into the ash bin of history. With it could go affirmative action, at least the consideration of race.
Also at issue in and around Washington, D.C. is the goings-on in Virginia. The details there is that there was a bill that was all ready to be approved, which would require a woman seeking an abortion not just to get an ultrasound, the kind that you get with the wand on the outside of the belly, but to get an ultrasound with a wand being inserted into the vagina, a so-called invasive or transvaginal ultrasound. On Wednesday, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell backed off his support. On Monday, Virginia House Delegate Charnel Herring spoke to protesters who were gathered outside the state capitol in Richmond.
We're calling you out. When you produce extreme bills that are not about a woman's health, we will continue to call you out until you step back from this extremist legislation.
David Ignatius, I don't know where you are situated or where you live there in the Washington, D.C. area, but what do we make of this walk back by the Virginia governor?
Well, I live in D.C., but I was fascinated by Governor McDonnell's move backward from something that he understood was so unpopular with constituents, or certainly with women constituents, that he just couldn't support it. He's been, in many ways, very conservative. But this was a bridge too far. I think it's a sign that on women's health issues, generally, women have been more assertive, and politicians are listening. And they're realizing that they need to be more careful before imposing their own yardsticks and litmus tests.
I'm Mike Pesca. This is On Point. And let's take a call from Beth, who's calling us from Niskayuna, New York. Hello, Beth.
Hi. Well, I got to backtrack a couple things. Okay. I'm going to move forward.
Tick off the list, Beth.
All right. Well, we're stepping on the neck of the Afghanis. And if people came into your house and started burning books and it was the last thing you had, I think you'd become outraged. But I'm going to go forward. All right. And the issue about the affirmative action, women are generally covered under it. And the average homeless person is a woman. So I'm sad to see that they picked a woman to pit against minorities because, you know, homelessness is about 50-50. There's, what, four men on this panel today? I say we're back in the 1960s. If you want a reasonably funded abortion, then you have to be well below the poverty line. And so I would say we're kind of back to the 60s with all these obstacles and things where a woman would have to pay for. It's not covered under Obamacare. Won't be covered under Obamacare, so a woman has to go through all of these steps, pay for everything, and you better believe she's going to have to be upper middle class to be able to afford it. It's the same old, minus the fact that back in the 60s you had to find the father, even if you were a rape victim, and get him to sign off on it. It's going to be for upper middle class women again, and because there's too many obstacles to it. And it's going to push women back into, it pushes women back into such a subservient role.
Beth, thank you for the call. Well, back in the 60s was pre Roe versus Wade, 1973. So that's a point to make. But Jack, you were going to say.
Well, I was going to say that Beth's comment is just, I thought just was so eloquent. You know, Justice Blackmun put it this way, that control of reproduction is essential to women's autonomy. And when you think about it, it's obvious that that's the case. Forced birth is not a humane option, whatever else it might be. And it saddles women with burdens that essentially limit their freedom. And that basic vision that women have to have some control over their reproductive rights in order to exercise their freedom as citizens, that's in danger, I think, of being blurred in all this debate and obfuscation.
David Shepardson, do you think the cultural issues are? I mean, there is a debate: are they a distraction, and where is the distraction coming from? But we can't seem to get away from them. Yet polling shows we want the solutions that our politicians offer to be primarily economic ones. What do you make of all that, David?
You know, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush made a speech yesterday where he said he thought the party is focusing too much on these cultural, especially negative, sort of ominous issues and not putting forward enough of a positive, optimistic agenda. And you're right, when you consider the focus on, is it birth control or, some of the cultural, social issues that might play better to the Republican base. I mean, these candidates have to pivot to a general election and to all the independent voters. And the other interesting point there is that this election or battle could drag on all the way to the convention, giving, sort of forcing the Republicans to stay further to the right for a longer period before pivoting back to the center. And the other interesting thing on the abortion, on this transvaginal procedure, mm-hmm. is that Virginia would have been the only state to explicitly require it, although the reality is other states require similar procedures, like Texas, which had its law just upheld. So they weren't as overt about it, but this procedure may still go forward in other states, and it may lead to more protests.
Right, and make no mistake, supporters of the procedure essentially want to show a woman here, this is your fetus on a screen, rethink your actions. That's why these bills are there, right?
Although they don't, I don't believe in Virginia, the woman would have had to look at it, but they would have. This would have had been performed. But that is clearly the intent of the law, is to try to dissuade people, women, from having abortions.
David Shepardson, Washington bureau chief for the Detroit News. Thank you for being here today. Have a fun time on Tuesday. Do you like that day as a reporter?
Well, how can you not? I mean, it's the big game, right?
That's why you get into the business. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, great to have you on. Thank you for your insights, sir.
Thanks, Mike.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, it was great. I always enjoy you as a listener. It was great to talk to you and have this opportunity. And have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. It's On Point Radio. I am Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point Radio.